it's just such a bummer because we can't fish it. You literally can't do it.
Unusual sea ice conditions hamper Bering Sea fishermen. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 13th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of Emonic struggle to pay the bills.
I had to decide between buying heating fuel or food.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Hillary Clinton says if she's confirmed as Secretary of State, Arctic issues will be a priority. Clinton testified today before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is considering her nomination as President-elect Barack Obama's Secretary of State. Clinton's comments came in response to a question from Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski about America's role as an Arctic nation.
You have been a leader on this issue, and I hope your time has come, Senator, because I believe that the issues of the Arctic are one of those long-term matters that will dramatically affect our commercial, our environmental, our energy futures that we have got to start attending to now.
Clinton noted that rapid sea ice melt is opening up the Arctic and raising significant questions about trade, borders, and development.
We know that there's going to be a necessity to map out our continental shelf. We know that there will be disputes over energy resources and minerals and other natural resources in the Arctic.
Clinton said she supports ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty and called it long overdue. The United Nations Convention defines the rights of seafaring countries, but the United States has not signed on to it. Senator Murkowski helped welcome President-elect Obama's Energy Secretary nominee to Capitol Hill today. As her party's ranking member on the Energy Committee, she was the first Republican to question Dr. Stephen Chu about his nomination. Chu is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who's dedicated to finding renewable energy solutions. At today's hearing, he received support from the Energy Committee, but also fielded tough questions. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Secretary nominee Stephen Chu started his opening comments by launching into the hot topic of the day and one that may drive his goals at the Department of Energy, climate change.
It is now clear that if we continue on our current path, we run the risk of dramatic disruptive changes to our climate in the lifetimes of our children and our grandchildren. At the same time, we face immediate threats to our economy and our national security that stem from our dependence on oil.
Senator Lisa Murkowski said she fully expects Chu to be confirmed as Energy Secretary. She and others pointed to his scientific accomplishments and applauded his commitment to renewable energy, ranging from solar, wind, and geothermal power to biomass. But on Tuesday, Murkowski pressed him on domestic oil and gas production. Chu said he supports President-elect Obama's call to look at development both on and offshore.
But the more efficient use of energy in the United States is the one big factor that can most help us decrease our dependency on foreign oil.
Murkowski was the first of many senators to ask Chu about his stance on nuclear power.
I am supportive of the fact that the nuclear industry should have to be part of our energy mix in this century. And so in going forward with that, we do need a plan on how to dispose of that waste safely over a long period of time.
Chu said as Energy Secretary, he'll encourage the best possible scientific research into nuclear disposal and said he believes nuclear recycling can be part of the solution, although the processes developed so far are not ideal. Chu was also asked by members of the committee to clarify his position on coal use. He'd been quoted as saying that burning coal for power is a nightmare.
I said that in the following context. If the world continues to use coal the way we're using it today, then it is a pretty bad dream. That is to say, in China, for example, they have not yet begun to even trap the sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxides. There's mercury, there's particulate matter, as well as carbon dioxide.
Chu said he does see coal as part of America's overall energy package, and he believes the nation should be a leader in developing technologies to capture carbon dioxide and safely sequester it. Taking a leadership role in science and developing new technologies was a repeated call from Chu, who looks poised to lead the Department of Energy in the next administration. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Senator Murkowski also dropped in on the confirmation hearing for the Education Secretary nominee. Arne Duncan is the chief of Chicago's public school system. Duncan received strong support from both Democrats and Republicans on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, on which Murkowski sits. Senators from rural areas expressed hope that Duncan would quickly come up to speed on their issues, given his background in an urban school system. Senator Murkowski said she wants to make sure he's aware of the challenges Alaska Native students face.
Our education statistics are not anything to be proud of as they relate to our Alaska Natives in terms of achievement, dropout rates, college enrollment. The gaps are wide and they are unacceptable.
Murkowski echoed other senators in pointing to high dropout rates as a major problem. Duncan said it will be one of his top priorities.
It's a huge issue, and I don't think there's a state in this country that could be really, really proud of that number. And as a country, I don't think we can be proud of what that number is today. So it's something that I need to have a laser-like focus on. This is, you know, complex in many factors, but I want to spend a lot of time figuring out how we dramatically increase the graduation rate, you know, obviously not overnight, but over time. And when our children drop out today, as you well know, we basically condemn them to social failure.
Today was Senator Murkowski's first time meeting Duncan. She invited him to visit Alaska in order to understand the challenges the state faces and see the success it's had with innovations in tele-education and distance learning. An abnormally high level of sea ice is covering the Bering Sea this winter. It's moving south faster than it has in more than 30 years, and it's causing problems for the snow crab fishermen. KUCB's Ann Hillman in Onalaska looked into the impacts.
Travis Arquette is a deckhand on the North American. He, like many other crab fishermen, is waiting around, trying to decide what to do about the sea ice.
When the ice pack starts moving down as fast as it is right now, it's just such a bummer. It's really it. In a nutshell, it's a bummer because we can't fish it. You literally can't do it.
The ice is already blocking off the harbor at St. Paul Island, where many boats deliver their quota. If boats can't reach the processors, it economically impacts the entire island. Stores get less business. The city brings in fewer taxes. Some fishermen say the ice is covering about 60% of the Opelio fishing grounds as well.
When you have ice that's covering the fishing grounds, then you just can't retrieve your pots. So if you drop your pots and you leave for a while, come back, and the ice has come over and, you know, just taken over your buoys and ripped the buoys off the pots, moved your pots around, and then you lose your pots. You can't catch them anymore. They're gone.
Crab pots cost more than $800 a piece, meaning the fleet could lose a lot of money for lost equipment in a year when crab prices are 53 cents per pound less than last season. Some crews have flown off the island and plan to return in March when the sea ice should be lower. Others are risking it. Jeff Rose on the Arctic Mariner says he's been in town for over 2 weeks loading and then offloading gear, first because of the world economy, and then because of the ice.
Well, it's totally changed our plan. We were going to go Opie fishing because the price of cod is down with the recession. And now we're almost forced into going cod fishing.
He says his boat will get 35 cents per pound for cod. That's higher than others are getting, but much lower than the 62 cents they were getting last season. But it's less risky than trying for opies or snow crab. Kathleen Cole with the Alaska Sea Ice Program at the National Weather Service says the ice is already between 60 and 100 miles further south than it was at this time last year.
if people have been in the area a long time and they think back to 1975, the ice is very similar to 1975 right now, which should scare everybody that was there because there was a lot of ice in 1975.
She says the ice should completely surround St. Paul and be down to St. George by the end of the week. Though this much ice is unusual, Cole says it's not unheard of. The ice is caused by a cold, high-pressure system that stretches from Russia into the interior of Alaska and has been sitting there for weeks. Cole explains that it will stay until a warm, low-pressure system enters the area.
Once the low-pressure systems, even if they're very warm, once they get over that ice, they have nothing to give them any energy. And so, you know, pushing their way through that strong area of high pressure that's so cold is going to be difficult. It's going to take a pretty powerful low to get up there and do that, which, again, isn't very good for fishing either because it means the winds will be strong.
Cole says the ice cover will be inconsistent until it fully retreats in March.
So it may be open in St. Paul for a stretch of 2, maybe 3 weeks, and then it may close up again for a week, and then the ice will go back and forth. And it's just going to be one of those years that we have to watch the ice carefully.
And that's what many of the crab fishermen are doing, watching the ice and waiting to decide what's next. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the bad economy hits the Yukon Quest.
That's really made sponsorship acquisition challenges in this year. You know, a lot of companies are being very cautious, you know, with their spending.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just pick, click, give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
Residents of the southwest Alaska village of Imanik are running out of food as a trifecta of bad circumstances have forced them into choosing between high-priced fuel or feeding themselves. A combination of a collapsed commercial fishery that left residents without summer income, an early fall freeze-up that prevented a final fall barge fuel shipment, and an unusual spell of extended cold has left residents in the Yupik village of 800 desperate. Resident Nicholas Tucker Sr. says he has had to spend $1,500 for heating fuel and propane for the last 2 months, leaving him with only $400 after the 9th to feed 9 people in his home.
And then it dawned on me, what about my neighbors? I made a VHF phone call and had people tell me exactly what's happening in their home. I had 25 calls in about 3 hours.
He says the stories he collected and submitted in a letter to the Bristol Bay Times are very sad.
Some of them literally have no food left. Don't know when their next meal is. No milk for their little ones. And some couple of elders have to go out quietly alone someplace and cry because they can't do anything. And husband calls me and crying. It's okay. He's letting his wife eat. As long as his wife and children eat, he'll be okay.
Tucker says with the collapse of last year's salmon fishery, people were left with little recourse beyond subsistence. He says the area has no other cash employment in resource development, such as oil, mining, or timber. Tucker says gasoline is $7.25 a gallon, and people looking for firewood are having to search longer and farther away for driftwood logs that are buried under snow. Heating oil is $7.83 a gallon, and until today, the cold had been relentless.
This anomaly where I have not seen cold strike us as early as late September, lasting and worsening through as the winter progresses from late September through a day ago. Today's Hawaiian weather at about 7 degrees above right now.
Fuel was recently airlifted into the community, and the price is expected to rise to $11 per gallon. With temperatures dropping to 30 below, Tucker says one woman told him she is paying only for food and fuel, unable to pay any other expenses. Some have had to drop village water and sewer, reverting to honey buckets and hauling water. He says community members are hoping for help from others.
We are in need of some Pampers, formula, milk for cereal, lunch items for dinner. Some of them are sacrificing. I mean, Dutch don't have anything for breakfast, lunch, or maybe a little bit, trying to save their little bit of moose meat. So that's those things are real things happening.
But he says there has been some response from Alaskans and others in the lower 48 who read his published letter and have promised to send donations. He says money sent to the tribal council will be used for fuel vouchers for those hardest hit or to subsidize the price of the airlifted fuel. He says the response from concerned individuals has been wonderful, but they're still hoping to hear from the state of Alaska for help. Imonik Tribal Administrator Christine Alexi says some calls offering dry goods and cash donations have come in. She says on Saturday the community will hold a small potlatch
and do a distribution to those families that they know that are really in need. And then we were also do a traditional what we've been doing regularly for the past couple of years, you know, with having community people volunteer to go out and catch a like two or three moose and have all that meat distributed to those families too.
Alexi says the council is working on proxies to do the hunting. Some elements of the state's tax on the mining industry have not been changed since before statehood. And with several new major projects under consideration this year, a bill rewriting the minerals fiscal regime is before the legislature. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The potential value of the mining industry eclipses the value of all the oil produced since first development on the North Slope. And the question Homer Republican Paul Seaton raises is, does Alaska get its fair share of the value of those minerals? Seaton has sponsored the new tax, and he answers no. He says it's time to increase the state's revenue from the industry. He says historically, Alaska has netted less than 2% of the value of its mineral resources.
It's been pretty small and insignificant, and especially when we're looking at large operations on state land. I think that we need to look at the return to Alaskans for the impacts that occur, not only the schools and the hospitals and those kind of things that have to be built and supported, but also, just the return to the state for providing all the other services and the value of our resources that are being taken out of state.
The bill's main point is to increase the state's mining license tax from a maximum of 7% of the net income to 11% of the gross income of the resource extracted. It would also change the calculation of the 3% state royalty for operations on state land. There would be more small, untaxed mines, focusing the tax on fewer operations. The Miners Association opposes the measure, pointing to the positive numbers they have. A study 2 years ago by the McDowell Research Group shows the industry pays $175 million a year in taxes, rent, and royalty. And Executive Director Steve Burrell says Seaton's proposed increase would take away the incentive for new development.
The person has to look at the return structure, if you will, for the mining industry, and you take another 4% of a person's profit away, and all of a sudden, that's going to make Alaska a bad place to do business. It's going to adversely impact exploration investment in Alaska. People will not want to come and look for minerals here.
Seaton says there could be several large mining projects in the near future, with all of them planned for land leased from the state. The Bristol Bay District includes the Pebble Mine and several other claims, a platinum mine near Yakutat, the Black Sands Platinum Prospect, and other development along the Aleutians. Pebble is furthest along in the process, although its owners haven't yet made a final decision on continuing development. Seaton says that project alone would equal or surpass oil's potential.
The Department of Revenue estimated about 6 months ago that the value of Pebble, the in-place mineral out there, was $350 to $500 billion, and the total value of all North Slope oil ever produced is $368 billion. So, you know, we're talking about a huge amount of resource, so you're talking about a lot of revenue for the state.
Burrell agrees the big impact from the tax increase will come from new mines where development has not yet begun. But he says that depends on whether they ever become mines. There's no guarantee any of them will proceed beyond the exploration phase. And he says the tax will adversely affect the state's existing mines. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Canadian mining company Teck Cominco is cutting jobs, but says the downsizing will not affect its Alaska operations. Teck announced last week that it's eliminating 1,400 jobs, or 13% of its worldwide workforce. The company operates the Red Dog Zinc Mine near Kotzebue and the Pogo Gold Mine outside Delta Junction. But Teck Alaska Corporate Affairs Director Carl Honeman says the job cuts are primarily aimed at the company's coal operations.
There will be significant changes in the coal sector in British Columbia, as well as the copper operations in South America and some of our exploration activities, just responding to soft commodity prices in many of our markets and the worldwide kind of financial slowdown.
Teck Cominco paid $14 billion for a large amount of Canadian coal assets last year and is facing big debt payments just as demand for coal falls off. Honeman says although Teck's Alaska operations are not targeted for job cuts, there are concerns about Red Dog due to the declining world economy.
Zinc has actually softened considerably and significantly, and we are quite concerned about the zinc business as well. But Red Dog operations have managed their staff levels through attrition, and there are no further cutbacks anticipated at Red Dog.
Honeman says current economic conditions are benefiting operations at the company's Pogo Gold Mine. The price of gold has remained high, and Honeman says lower energy prices are an added benefit.
Both in our direct fuel purchases as well as our purchase power costs, as Golden Valley costs have come down. So as the gold price remains stable and our cost inputs go down, that'll certainly help in the short run for Pogo.
Honeman says the hard rock underground mine may reach an important milestone later this year. Pogo, which began operation in February 2006, is expected to produce its millionth ounce of gold late in 2009.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Copper Basin Sled Dog Race is nearly wrapped up. 20 mushers have finished the 300-mile race. Lance Mackey won the Copper Basin yesterday. The Iditarod and Yukon Quest champion crossed the finish line in Lake Louise at 4:41 p.m. Monday. Hans Gott was second, coming in at 5:24. Brent Sass was next, less than a half hour later. 27 teams started the race on Saturday. Yukon Quest officials are hustling to fill out the race's budget before next month's start. Quest director Tanya Simpson says it's unusual to be looking for money to shore up the race in January, but that this year's situation is tougher than normal.
What is unusual is, you know, the current state of the economy, and that's really made sponsorship acquisition challenging this year. You know, a lot of companies are being very cautious, you know, with their spending.
A major Quest fundraiser wrapped up over the weekend with disappointing results. Simpson says the raffle event, which usually brings in $10,000, raised only $2,500.
You know, though we did raise some money, it was certainly, you know, almost a quarter of what we normally raise. So we're seeking, you know, community and individual and corporate support, and would encourage anyone that is, you know, able to or interested in supporting the Yukon Quest to give us a call.
The Quest issued a statement to Mushers Friday warning that it could only guarantee $125,000 of the planned $200,000 purse.
We felt that, you know, it was fair to come out to our mushers and say, as of this date, you know, this is what we currently have. We certainly plan to, you know, advise them of, you know, of how things are progressing over the next couple of weeks.
Simpson says efforts continue to restore the purse to the full amount and that so far no major cuts have been made to other parts of the race budget. The withdrawal deadline has been extended to allow mushers to pull out and only lose $150 of their $1,500 entry fee. Prior to the extension, Simpson says three of the 40 mushers dropped out.
Jesse Beebe, he unfortunately hit a moose last week and totaled his truck and hurt his back. Simon McLaughlin has a neck injury, and Sonny Lidner as well withdrew last week.
Simpson says Lidner had chosen to focus on the Iditarod. Four-time defending Quest champion Lance Mackey and 2008 runner-up Ken Anderson reportedly have plans to pull out, but Simpson says she has not received official requests from either musher. Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne announced funding for the second round of National Park Service Centennial Challenge projects today. The program aims to upgrade visitor centers and education facilities at national parks throughout the nation in the lead-up to the National Park Service Centennial in 2016. Last year, 138 projects were funded in the first round of a 10-year program. This year, the funding and project undertakings were modest at only 9 projects and $10.5 million in federal funds, with another $16.5 coming in from other organizations. Two of the 9 projects are in Alaska. Kempthorne says $200,000 will go for improved visitor facilities at Kenai Fjord's Exit Glacier. Half the money is coming from Alaska Geographic. National Park Service spokesman Jeffrey Olson says park education for visitors is the goal.
Phase one of that project is construction of an 800-square-foot education pavilion, which will be adjacent to the Nature Center. That'll provide some staging areas for educational groups and for facilitated programs. The first thing that gets going is plan and design of exhibits and interior modifications to make sure everything fits.
Another $100,000 will go toward visitor entryway improvements at Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. $50,000 comes from the Stephen and Mary Birch Foundation. Olson says because the Park Service is operating on a continuing resolution, they were authorized to spend only 43% of allocated funds in this year. He anticipates more projects in the coming years.
The wheels are just out there spinning right now in the minds of park rangers, of park superintendents, and of the members of friends groups. And the longer that this project is in place and on the ground, we get more ideas. We get submissions for newer projects. And it's just kind of starting to really gain traction on the ground. So we look for great things in the future.
Olson says the Centennial Challenge program requires a match to federal funds from private organizations or state and local governments. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.